We're both lawyers, but we're not your lawyer.
Exactly.
So this is not legal advice, but we're hoping that what we're telling you here might help lead you in the right direction. Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman.
Once again, we're going to talk about some news related to the coronavirus. This week, it will be the new federal relief bills and what new requirements and opportunities these laws might have for houses of worship.
In our final segment, we will talk about how we are seeing religion respected in what we're reading and listening to during this continued time of social distancing.
Well, Holly, we continue to social distance for these conversations, but we're not the only ones in Washington engaged in social distancing these days.
We are not the only ones who are getting tired of seeing everybody in these little Zoom boxes, but that is what we must do to do our part and keep us all safe.
Yeah, so the entire Washington region is now under stay-at-home orders, as is most of the country, we know now. And even the Supreme Court is continuing on with its business and holding conferences, but they're doing so remotely. And I think the reports were that Chief Justice Roberts was the only one at the Supreme Court when they had their conference this time. So
I know. That paints a sad portrait, doesn't it?
I know. Lonely. Well, and Capitol Hill is getting lonelier too. Congress has left to go home. They finished their business, and unless they're called back on more urgent business, we won't see the senators back in Washington till April 20th. So Washington is a quieter place these days.
In our conversation today, we will talk about what Congress did as they left town and dropped to the third phase of their stimulus package. But we've already heard some talk of additional phases. So we will just keep following these stories and have this conversation just as of now, knowing that it will change. Makes me think that we might have to rename our podcast from Respecting Religion to Considering Coronavirus.
I know. That's just the state of our country right now. This is not just the top news or the front page news, but all the news, and rightfully so. Our country hasn't faced a crisis like this before, and it is implicating all parts of our life. And last week, we had a conversation on Respecting Religion, not quite ready to rename the podcast yet, but about some of the free exercise implications with the stay-at-home orders and what that meant for houses of worship. And we've seen continued development of that news since we had our conversation last week. We've actually seen criminal action taken against some pastors for violating those orders. And just today, as we're having our conversation, I heard Vice President Pence has urged all religious gatherings of more than 10 people to cease for the time being. So we're seeing some leadership on the national level calling for the end of that.
Yeah, our conversation really focused on sort of that free exercise need that we take for granted, that free exercise right and need that we take for granted is one of our basic ways of being religious people, and that is to gather in congregations, and our different ways, different religious traditions do that. And of course, we had to respond like the rest of society to the important health crisis that's going on, but it raised these issues of, you know, can the government tell us what to do? And we were, you know, discussing last week how the government's interest in protecting the health and safety is one of its highest interests. It's what government does. And yes, there have been continuing stories about congregations and religious leaders leading in helping our government and working with the government, as well as a few stories of them challenging our government.
And we know that the impact of these stay-at-home orders, or at least we hope, the desired effect is to slow the spread of the virus, to help us get on the other side of this public health crisis. And we also know that there's a pretty severe economic impact of all these closures. We hear about the impact on the restaurant industry, for instance, lots of small businesses who rely on in-person business and sales to survive. So we know that as small businesses suffer, so do nonprofits. And of course, houses of worship, churches, synagogues, mosques, those are nonprofits. They are suffering as well, and some will close because of these forced closures and stay-at-home orders.
That's right. And that brings us to this discussion we're going to have today about this recent federal legislation and how it affects churches, and just putting this in context of our BJC, the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, and our approach to protecting religious liberty and having respectful conversations about it. The American tradition and our Constitution protects religious freedom by protecting both the free exercise of religion and prohibiting the establishment of religion. And that no establishment clause, that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, is often debated and discussed, and people have different fight over the precise meaning of it. But it goes back to our history, and it has to do with government staying out of religious matters, not advancing religion. And one of the primary factors about that is not promoting religion with money. So as we talked about free exercise religious liberty concerns that are arising today, when we start talking about federal legislation and money that impacts churches, it brings to mind the Establishment Clause and raises these questions about how does the Establishment Clause protect religious liberty?
Yeah, and you and I have been fielding some questions and curiosities about what exactly BJC thinks about some of these stimulus measures that include churches and what our thoughts are on the religious liberty implications. And when several people contacted about us, we thought this is a topic that would be good for us to discuss on the podcast. Also something good to have some written reflections out there. And Holly, you've got a new piece out on BJC's Medium site that listeners can also look to that kind of lays out how we at BJC approach the issues and giving some of our best thoughts right now. You know, this is moving so fast. These bills that we're talking about here, and we'll get into the specifics in just a minute, but the last one was just passed and signed into law on Friday, you know, 5 days right before we're having the conversation here, and applications are going to start being accepted for some of these loans this Friday.
That's right.
And so this is moving so fast, and a little fast for comfort as far as being able to really dive in and understand all the complexities of this law. And yet people need some reflections now when they're determining kind of whether to apply for some of this relief and what all the implications are.
That's right. I think of people are learning about this congressional act in different ways. You know, we may take for granted living in the nation's capital where you live and breathe news and political interest, you know, that we get all this information and we know we sift through it and try to get the best sources. But, you know, this is affecting people all over the country that are eager to learn about and figure out if there is aid from the federal government to help them in these times. And so some of the questions that we've received are where people have gotten information not from news sources, not from government sources. Those sources tell us, as we monitor this closely, that it's a developing story. There is some guidance. We're getting more information. There'll be some more like that. But other people are just hearing, hey, there's this pot of money, go get it. So that's causing a lot of stress and anxiety or excitement, well-founded or not. So that's the context in which we're having this conversation today.
Yeah. And before we talk about that large pot of money, I think it's important to note first the second of three stimulus bills that was passed by the Congress, but the first one that had implications for houses of worship and other nonprofits is an act called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. It was signed into law on March 18th, and I'll note here that there are a lot of resources out there, and I commend in particular some that our friends at the National Council of Nonprofits have put out, and we'll put a link to their information in the show notes. some of the denominational partners we work with as well have been doing some great leading work on this, and particularly our friends at UCC, United Church of Christ. And so we do not claim to be the premier experts on all these new bills, but we do want to share those resources and talk more about them. But first, I guess, this Families First Coronavirus Response Act, a little bit of a mouthful, but it hasn't gotten much conversation or play around some new mandates that are applying for even very small nonprofits and houses of worship, that they're under new requirements to provide paid sick leave and paid medical and family leave for their employees who have been affected by coronavirus and COVID-19.
Yeah, and I would recommend the memo that we will post from the UCC, as well as a wonderful webinar that they did. A lot of churches might be familiar just in general with the Family Medical Leave Act. They might be familiar with it and saying, hey, it doesn't apply to us because we have less than 50 employees. And it is true that that big piece of federal legislation was passed, of course, to give unpaid leave to people who had to be home to take care of a sick one. So that family medical leave, it's for your own medical needs and leave to take care of a close family member. That's the general federal law. And this new piece of legislation, this Families First Act, extends and alters the Family Medical Leave Act and requires some paid sick leave in ways that will affect small employers, including churches, in ways that are different from that traditional federal legislation.
And I think Congress, understanding that this new mandate would help employees, also didn't want to hurt employers financially in the process. And so any of this aid or leave that the employer gives to employees impacted in this way, the employer would be eligible for a payroll tax credit to help cover that cost. And so for us, again, from a legal or constitutional standpoint, if you're going to apply a mandate across the board that impacts houses of worship, then it feels fair that the compensation that come from the government to help you handle that new mandate would be evenly available as well.
That's right. It illustrates and reminds us that, of course, the government regulates religious entities in some ways. Of course, it can put requirements on us. And this is what it's doing in this specific time to, again, protect employment and really address this specific need. It is a little bit peculiar, so people should look to reputable legal resources to make sure they follow it correctly. We'll talk about when we get to the next subject, or as I can tell you now, that as Congress came back, that was the second phase. As they came to the third phase, they had to alter something in the second phase, or at least how these two relate to each other. I say that not to be confusing, but just to be understanding that you have to look very specifically at what each act requires to be in compliance or to take advantage of it for your employees.
It's understandable that Congress acted so quickly in trying to move this legislation. And it's also understandable when there are circumstances that come up that say, oh, we need to take another look at this, or we need to provide more clarity, or maybe through regulations when they're implementing it. This is a developing story. Just another reminder here that we're going to continue to see how this unfolds as it becomes enacted. And this Families First Coronavirus Response Act, it took effect today, April 1st, and these new provisions are now in effect through the end of 2020.
Right. My understanding is that there will not be enforcement actions, at least for 30 days. And I say that just to know that that laws often recognize it takes a while to adapt to these. And again, you can look at Department of Labor regulations and some other resources that we'll put up to see exactly how they might apply to your church or in other employers.
Yeah. As our friend Tim Delaney at the National Council of Nonprofits said on a webinar this week, we're both lawyers, but we're not your lawyer.
Exactly.
So this is not legal advice, but we're hoping that what we're telling you here might help lead you in the right direction.
And I think it fits with what most churches would want to do. And as they try to adapt right now, and they understand sort of this overall societal interest in trying to keep people employed. And to do that now, it may require more leave and to take care of people, more paid leave than what is normally required of small employers.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into the CARES Act, the most recently passed federal stimulus, and what that might mean for houses for sale.
Okay, we're back. And we're going to talk about the CARES Act, which was the third phase of this stimulus legislation and the one that Congress left on Friday as they then went their various ways into greater isolation. And the CARES Act includes a part that, of course, got a lot of attention because there were headlines like, here's how to get a small business loan under the $349 billion coronavirus aid bill. That's what I saw in the Washington Post.
Wow, $349 billion. But the whole package was $2 trillion, dwarfing prior stimulus packages that Congress has put out in other important times of crisis. So before we get to that $349 billion, I wanted to highlight an incentive, an increased charitable giving incentive that's part of the package that is really important for nonprofits. It shows, I think, Congress understands the generosity of Americans and wants to provide continued incentives and increased incentives during this time for continued generosity, even when they are facing economic hardships themselves. So Congress, you know, what Congress takes away, they can give back. With the tax law that they passed back in 2018, they really curtailed the charitable giving incentives, which was a problem for a lot of nonprofits. But for 2020, at least, they have added back, and all taxpayers, whether they itemize their deductions or not, and the vast majority of taxpayers now do go with a standard deduction and don't itemize their deductions, but everyone can get a deduction, what's called an above-the-line deduction, for total charitable contributions of up to $300. So $300, you know, in the grand scheme of things, and for some taxpayers, not a lot of charitable giving over the course of the year, but enough that should encourage generosity from all Americans who are already looking for ways to give back during this time. So that is a really helpful incentive that everyone can take advantage of.
It's good to see Congress recognizing that and sort of the multiple ways that the nonprofit sector works with the rest of the economy. So that, of course, it's probably not the primary reason people give to nonprofits, but it is an incentive that will help some people. And maybe people who are thinking now, maybe they're not in the habit of giving, but thinking now about the great need. And, you know, some people I've heard say, you know, well, the government's giving this money out. We didn't talk about the first phase of the stimulus. This was more about, you know, immediate paychecks to citizens. But I heard some people saying, you know, should government really be doing that? Maybe some people were saying, I don't need the money. I'd rather them give that money to someone who could use it better. And, you know, of course, the answer to that is if you get that check and you can better use it, give it to a nonprofit that you know is doing good work and meeting the needs of people. So I like how this charitable giving incentive sort of goes with the overall big picture of what's going on now.
Absolutely. And then also for the, you know, minority of taxpayers who still do itemize, estimated, you know, be somewhere between 8 and 13% of taxpayers, or according to the figures or estimates that I've seen. But it also really increases the incentive for those taxpayers. Currently, they can itemize or deduct up to 60% of their adjusted gross income donations that they give. Under this law for 2020, 100% of their adjusted gross income, they can deduct their charitable giving. So that's great to lift that cap. And again, hopefully we'll provide an extra incentive for Americans to be generous during this time. And then we're going to get to, I guess, the piece that's gotten a lot more attention. And that's something that's called the Paycheck Protection Program loans, the $349 billion. It's an emergency loan program that provides loans of up to $10 million each for eligible nonprofits and small businesses. And to be eligible, you just have to have less than 500 employees. And if you apply for one of these loans, you can do so to help cover costs of payroll primarily, but also other operations and debt service. And if it is meant to incentivize and help employers keep their employees on their payroll through this time to try to slow that incredible loss of jobs that so many Americans are facing right now. And so if through these loans, the small businesses and nonprofits are able to keep employees on their staff or rehire them by June 30th, then their loans can be forgiven in whole or in part.
Right. And the fact that this paycheck protection program alters the Small Business Administration's regs, or it's operated through the Small Business Administration and extends to nonprofits, is a big change, right?
Yeah, just that, the fact that nonprofits are eligible like other small businesses.
Yeah,
that's not usual.
It is not usual for nonprofits to be included in the definition of small businesses for these small business loans. So that's a big change. And while the statute says on its face, says that it provides relief for small businesses, including nonprofits, and it doesn't specifically mean churches, it presumably includes churches. And we know from other sources of information that it was, of course, intended to cover churches.
Right. And in case there was any doubt about that, this week we saw some members of Congress who helped pass this to clarify for the Small Business Administration and other federal agencies that are going to be implementing the law that they did indeed mean to include houses of worship. And they had to clarify because part of the application process says, oh, and when you apply, you need to present your letter proving your 501c3 status. Well, houses of worship are not required to apply for 501c3 status. They are presumed to be charitable. It's considered the lifting of a burden for houses of worship to be able to have that presumption not go through the process. Again, just like it's not usual for nonprofits to be eligible for Small Business Administration loans, it's not usual for houses of worship to be eligible for these Small Business Administration loans either.
It's not usual for churches who are going through economic strains to seek an answer from the government. It's not usual for government to incentivize and protect the economic fortunes of houses of worship. That's not part of our tradition, our constitutional tradition.
But like we said, we fielded some questions about this from houses of worship, perhaps because it is so unusual, but it's so novel. These are new issues, and they're being told that, and we're hearing from the field that because it's a limited pot of money, $349 billion sounds huge, but when you consider how many small businesses and nonprofits would be eligible for these, it really is quite limited in such a way that people who are deciding whether they need to apply for these loans need to do so quickly, or the money is likely to be gone by the time they make up their mind.
Yeah, it's both understandable and very unfortunate that this has to move so fast, that the law just gets passed. The implementing regulations are still in the works, coming out day by day with more expected soon. And then the loans will be available just, you know, a week after the legislation was passed. And a lot of times people are getting information. The information they're getting is hurry quick because the money's going to run out. And we know a lot of churches are not comfortable making a decision or analyzing something in this state of anxiety.
Yeah, I think we've talked in our conversations before here about having a theology of abundance, right? And this government scarcity here conflicts with that. And I think it puts people in a difficult position. And so, you know, we understand that, especially in tough times, this would be desirable. And I want to emphasize, as you did in your piece that we have up on Medium, that, you know, we're not trying to encourage or discourage churches from applying for this money, but we think that it's important that we consider what some of the downsides might be so that they can make a more informed decision as they're maybe hearing pressure from others. Hurry, hurry, quick, apply now.
I'm thankful that we can have this conversation on this podcast as well for anyone who may be new to BJC and our perspective based upon our history and theology, but also the American constitutional tradition that treats religion in special ways and that is skeptical about any kind of financial entanglements between the institutions of religion and government. So some of these questions that we got were because people understand that religion should not rely on government. At the same time, they are facing unprecedented pressure and understand this congressional act to be a temporary and very specific measure to address this coronavirus crisis. And in some ways say, you know, this may not set a precedent for anything else, for the kinds of funding schemes that we've seen in normal times that really raise basic church-state questions.
So let's get to that first. It's not the only consideration, but when we think about that question, you know, is this constitutional? You know, one, just to state kind of the obvious, but we won't know if it's constitutional until someone might challenge it in court and it works its way all the way up to the Supreme Court who decides those kinds of questions.
Yeah, what is constitutional is what five members of the U.S. Supreme Court say is constitutional. It seems a little premature to try to answer the constitutional question in the middle of a crisis when you're looking at legislation that just was passed and the implementing regulations aren't quite in place under circumstances that we've never faced before as a country. I think what we want to talk about is why people are thinking of this as a constitutional question. And Amanda, we've talked, I think, in earlier discussions a little bit about changes in the Supreme Court and changes in church-state law that have been happening in recent years. And there are good resources about recent case law on BJC's website at bjconline.org. For our conversation today, it may be helpful just to say why a constitutional issue arises. And as we mentioned earlier, the no establishment clause prevents government itself from doing our religion for us, for advancing religion, for taking positions on essentially religious matters. And the question arises when people look at this particular legislation, is this government giving money to churches? So that's why people want to think in constitutional terms. There are different ways to look at this. You can see our thinking and some resources as we try to help people work through this need and this opportunity presented by this legislation.
And given in that piece, we talk about how given changes in the case law, changes in the court, and the way that this program is put together, which is a loan program that is forgivable in some instances, that it has important differences, significant differences from other kinds of direct aid programs that we've seen in other situations. So,
right. That's right. To the extent that it is a loan program allowing churches to go get a loan, just like small businesses normally may get loans, and with the same terms, the same requirements as others, it would not raise constitutional concerns. The fact that there is also a forgiveness element to this, that you could get a loan and not have to pay it back, raises this issue of, is this really just a grant to churches? And it is not a direct grant, but it would have a similar effect in that money would be going to churches that churches don't have to pay back. Money coming from banks, guaranteed by the government, and the government deciding not to enforce those loan provisions against churches. So that's the issue that makes people think about this in constitutional terms. Again, that is just one way of thinking about this. And most churches will have to decide whether to take advantage of this based upon their best information, their immediate needs. Hopefully they're thinking their long-term strategy about how they're going to continue and care for not only their employees, but their community in the ways that they always do, you know, in this moment now and in the future.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of when I've heard it talked about, and as we've discussed it, we've heard reports that people talk about, well, yeah, these are forgivable loans and there are no strings attached, right? Because usually when you think about government grants, the government is telling you, well, you can only use this money on these particular programs. Here, it's on your payroll and on some of your operating expenses. So I think that those words, no strings attached, are a little misleading in this context, because it's not like there are no accountability measures in place here.
I've heard that too, that some people are saying that they are interested in this program in ways that they wouldn't normally be interested in any kind of government aid or relief program because there are no strings attached. I think people mean different things by that. Having looked at some of the statutory language and some of the regulations, I can guarantee that it doesn't say, quote, no strings attached, unquote.
And that's a good thing. We're talking about $350 billion. I'd be worried if they said free for all for this money.
Exactly. That really underscores a point that we make and that we know people appreciate, and that is that church-state separation in general is good for religious institutions and it's good for the government. So you don't have to be a Baptist, descendant of people who bled and died because of their conscience speaking up against the coercive powers of the state that were making religious laws in order to understand that there might be important and significant consequences of taking government money.
Yeah, and some of those we know, and some of those we don't know at this stage, right? We've seen the four-page boilerplate application that people who are interested in applying for these loans would need to fill out. And even on the face of that application, we see some pieces that churches might not be prepared to disclose to the government or understand or appreciate, and if the level of entanglement that the government will have necessarily so, but in their financial affairs to certify their financial health, their payroll, all that information that they're going to ask for if you're applying for this loan.
That's right. The basic formula is to put in your average monthly payroll, and there's a formula. You multiply that times 2.5 to come up with what your amount is that you're asking for. But there are some limits to that, and you have to look at the regulations to see, and it depends on your number of employees and whatnot. But you have to make these certifications to make sure that you're entitled to this money. And those are understandable, legitimate reasons to try to make sure that the money goes to those people who need it most. And there are regulations that came out even after we got some information, we got new information about what you will have to certify about how you spend that money. There will be now requirements that a certain percentage of that money actually be spent on payroll and not on these other allowable expenses relating to rent or mortgage payments and other things. So those are accountability measures. You might call those strings. They definitely put the borrower in a different position, at least for many churches, a different position in relation to the government than is their normal affairs. And another way that people might think about, are there strings here, is what are the later implications of having taken this money? And we don't know. What kind of precedent does this set? Will this be seen as something that is justifiable as a response to an incredible, medical health emergency with huge economic impacts and as just as a temporary measure? Or will this be something that people use to argue fundamentally alters the relationship between religious institutions and government?
Yeah, and at a minimum, it seems to be blurring that line between church and state. And it's not that that was even a clear, absolute distinction before this legislation, but this further blurs that line. And so, for those reasons, again, not encouraging or discouraging churches who might be interested in this program, but I think at a minimum, it shouldn't be their first place to look for economic relief. If there are other places that they can find a way to make it through this really difficult time that are more certain, then that feels like a better course of action than kind of going off after this brand new program that we are still finding out about as applications open.
And we don't know, and we won't know for a while, what are the implications for taking money on continued giving to nonprofits. To bring us back to where we started this segment, we serve many churches and individuals who are involved in their houses of worship or people who care very much about that part of the charitable sector. And at times we have seen that when nonprofit organizations take money from government sources, it can have a negative impact on their ability to continue to raise money the same way they have from individuals.
And that's another reason we're grateful in the CARES Act that while there is a limit of $349 billion for this particular loan program, there's no limit to people's generosity. And that we hope and pray that people will continue to be generous as they're able during this really difficult time, because so many nonprofits, including houses of worship, will continue to rely on that individual generosity to make it through. So we'll take a quick break and hope you'll come back as we continue our conversation.
Okay, welcome back. And this third segment is where we like to talk about what we are hearing, seeing, and reading around us in the culture and in the news and in our neighborhoods respecting religion. And as we have this conversation today, I have one word.
What is it?
Webinars.
I know. That's like a new full-time job, right? In addition to being an at-home preschool, you could just go to webinars all day.
Exactly. But seriously, I have been appreciative of people putting together good work and trying to get information out there and sharing their stories and talking about their needs. And I have to say, following our earlier discussion, I've heard from some very thoughtful church leaders who understand not only the importance of church-state separation and want to protect their legacy of separation, who are really thinking about not how to continue to fund their ministry using government loans or guarantees, but just how to keep things afloat for the people who need it the most. In many situations, this is for daycare providers that the church employs in some kind of affiliated ministry or affiliated part of their church. So while they would never want to take money to keep the church going for its religious ministries or clergy pay or to pay for the church building. They're trying to think about how they can get through these next few months when the daycare center is closed down and it is operated just based on the money that people pay that then pays the salaries of the daycare workers.
Yeah, and for many of those, tuition payments have either been halved or stopped altogether, and they're trying to keep this workforce employed, right? And those are really noble aims, and we're learning a lot about how these churches are ministering.
And we know that all those parents are going to need a place for their kids to go as soon as they are able to do so without great threat to the public health
situation. That's right. It cannot come a moment too soon, speaking as one of these parents who has suddenly been thrust into the role of a preschool teacher.
That's right.
So I heard a really moving story this weekend from NPR, and Lulu Garcia Navarro talked to a chaplain at the University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle, a chaplain named Mike Yonkers. And, you know, when we think about how religion is respected and practiced in this time, it was really enlightening and heartwarming to hear about how hospital chaplains are ministering in creative new ways, sometimes needing to be socially distanced, to those who are in the hospitals. First, to those who are ill in the hospitals, and you know, usually these chaplains who are there to minister to their needs, whatever their religious tradition is, are able to be present with the patients. And because of how infectious this disease is, they're not able to be present in the same ways. And this story told a beautiful story about how this chaplain prayed over someone by writing a prayer specific to him and then asking the nurse to hold it over the paper, to hold it over this patient, and thinking about the comfort that that must have brought. But also he talked about how he's ministering to the hospital staff. And I think it was a really needed reminder about the toll that this kind of illness and loss of life and crisis situation and fear is having on those who are on the front lines of delivering medical care, and how for those people, he is able to be physically present. He is able to minister to them in ways that maybe they haven't typically needed him in these ways. So this was one person's story. I am sure it is replicated across the country in so many different hospitals and providers, and I'm really grateful these chaplains.
It's a great story about how chaplains work and respond to the needs of those around them. I love that story because it also just illustrates how we see religion all around us and the many different creative ways that people are adapting to continue to care for each other in respectful ways. So I look forward to looking for more stories like that, to hear ways that people are caring for people in new creative ways and how we can all be respectful of religion's role and our religious differences.
It can feel hard to find some good news right now.
That's right.
Times that we can find how religion is helping people through this crisis, we want to continue to lift up those stories in these conversations. That brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or earbuds during this time of social distancing. For more details on what we discussed today, including links to the articles we mentioned, check out the show notes that go with this episode.
Stay safe and be sure to join us on Thursday for our next episode in this podcast series. You can see a list of all of them on our website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss an episode. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill. And you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. and get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith, freedom for all since 1936.
Join us again next week for a new conversation, Respecting Religion.